Brown, a large, portly, graying man with troubled eyes. Roosevelt's rejection of his advances last night had stunned and shamed him. His mood today was not improved by an editorial in The World calling him a pygmy in comparison with his giant predecessor, Roscoe Conkling. Arthur's men were equally sullen and silent as they trooped into the opera house. There was a round of polite applause for Chairman Warren when he mounted the stage. More applause, rather less polite, greeted Warner Miller. He took an aisle seat next to Titus Sheard on Woodpulp Row, the section allotted to Herkimer County. Roosevelt, with his usual unerring sense of timing, waited until all three dignitaries were settled before making his own entrance. Then he stomped briskly down the hall to the sound of mounting applause that was taken up by the gallery and prolonged for some moments after he sat down, a mere yard away from Miller, on the opposite side of the aisle. Casually draping a leg over the chair in front, he allowed his personality to penetrate every corner of the auditorium. From that moment on, there was no doubt as to who was controlling the convention. When Chairman Warren had finished calling the roll, he simply cast his eye over toward Roosevelt, who leaped up and proposed that an Edmonds man be nominated temporary chairman of the meeting. The motion was approved. By late afternoon, when the votes for delegates at large were counted, it was plain that Warner Miller had, as the Sun correspondent put it, been pulverized finer than his own pulp. Roosevelt's name led the list with 472 votes. His three colleagues, all independents, were President Andrew D. White of Cornell University with 407, State Senator John J. Gilbert with 342, and Edwin Packard, a millionaire spice merchant from Brooklyn, with 256. Boss Miller ran fifth with only 243 votes, scarcely half Roosevelt's total, and six short of any kind of majority. His humiliation was complete. Word went around that his days as party chief were over. Flushed with victory, Roosevelt jumped across the aisle and confronted the shaken senator. According to one reporter, he held out his hand and said, "Time makes all things even. The 1st of January is avenged." But the reporter was a long distance away in the press gallery and got his quote by proxy. Actually, Roosevelt's hand was not so much extended as balled in a fist, and his words were rather less printable. "There, damn you, we beat you for last winter." "What did you want to say that for?" asked Isaac Hunt afterward. They were walking back to Bagg's Hotel behind Miller, who had somehow torn his trousers coming out of the opera house and now looked infinitely pathetic. "I wanted him to know," Roosevelt replied. Hunt was not impressed. "Well, I should think he would know without being told." This exchange, in effect, ended the 3-year friendship of the two young assemblymen, which had never been the same since Hunt's disloyalty during the speakership contest. There is no evidence that Roosevelt took any petty offense at his colleague's words, but he knew now that it was time to unrope himself from Hunt, O'Neill, and the other Roosevelt Republicans, whose horizons extended no further than New York State, and eagerly search out new altitudes, wider vistas. Chicago beckoned, and beyond it, the West. Could he but rise high enough, he might see his future clear. "He grew right away from me," Hunt confessed ruefully in old age. "I knew he was born for some great emergency, but what he would do I could not tell. I never expected to see him go right up in the heavens." Roosevelt returned to Albany on 24 April to receive the congratulations of his supporters in the assembly. "For a while," remarked the Times, "it was a doubtful question whether the chamber was being used for legislative purposes or as a Roosevelt reception room." During the next few days, he enjoyed such adulation, both public and private, as he had never enjoyed before, and would not experience again for at least a decade. The New York Times hailed him as the victor, the wearer of all laurels at Utica, and the Evening Post, in the course of a long and flattering editorial, called him the most successful young politician of our day. Curiosity mounted in Chicago and Washington about the 25-year-old who had almost single-handedly made Senator Edmonds a serious candidate for the presidency. Arthur Cutler, who kept closely in touch with political trends and took pedagogic pride in his ex-pupil, assured Bammy, "Theodore's reputation is national, and even to us who know him, it is phenomenal. Whatever the future may have in store for him, no man in the country has begun his public career more brilliantly." 200 miles away in Boston, Henry Cabot Lodge, another Edmonds supporter and delegate-at-large to Chicago, decided that Roosevelt was a national figure of real importance, and made a mental note to cultivate him. Roosevelt's post-convention glow was chilled by news that Grover Cleveland was threatening to veto some of his bills for the regulation of New York City. The assemblyman reacted with understandable shock. He had been so frequent a visitor to the executive office recently, and Cleveland had seemed so agreeable to all his legislation, that Roosevelt no doubt expected full cooperation through the concluding weeks of the session. Only a few days before Utica, Harper's Weekly had published a NAST cartoon showing the governor obediently signing a pile of these same bills in Roosevelt's presence. Others, however, had seen signs of a showdown long ago. It was not so much a question of politics as of diametrically opposed personalities. Roosevelt was nervy, inspirational, passionate. He arrived at conclusions so rapidly that he seemed to be acting wholly on impulse, and was impatient when those with more laborious minds did not instantly agree with him. Cleveland, on the other hand, was slow, stolid, objective, almost maddeningly conscientious. No bill was too lengthy or too complex for him to scrutinize it down to the last punctuation mark. His fathomless legal mind absorbed all data indiscriminately, sorted them into logical sequence, then issued an opinion which had about it the finality of a commandment chiseled in marble. One might as well try to sandpaper the marble smooth as to get Cleveland to change his mind. "I never see those two together," said Daniel S. Lamont, the governor's secretary, "that I'm not reminded of a great mastiff solemnly regarding a small terrier, snapping and barking at him." William Hudson of the Brooklyn Daily Eagle used a different metaphor. Cleveland was the immovable object, whereas Roosevelt was the irresistible force. Any confrontation between them was bound to generate heat, and good copy besides. So when Hudson met Roosevelt in State Street, shortly after his return from Utica, he lost no time in telling him about Cleveland's objections to his city reform bills. The reaction was predictable. "He mustn't do that. I can't have that. I won't let him do it. I'll go up and see him at once." With that, Roosevelt turned and began to sprint up the hill. The reporter, scenting a story, hurried after him. Roosevelt was already pounding on Cleveland's desk when Hudson arrived in the executive office. The governor proceeded to explain that the bills, while admirable in intent, had been too hastily written. They contained several inconsistencies which would render them ineffective as laws. Not the least of these non sequiturs was a clause in the tenure of office bill specifying two different terms, of 4 years and 1 year 11 months, respectively, for the same officer. There were sentences and other measures which were incomprehensible even by legal standards. The mere addition of a word or two would repair their logic. He would not sign them as presently drawn. Bristling, Roosevelt declared that principle was the main thing, that it was too late to worry about arcane details. "You must not veto those bills. You cannot. You shall not. I won't have it." At this, Cleveland gathered up all his 300 pounds and considerable height, visibly mushrooming in his chair. "Mr. Roosevelt, I'm going to veto those bills." His fist crashed down with such force as to make the assemblyman seek sanctuary in a chair, muttering something about an outrage. But Cleveland had already returned to his work. The interview was over. Thus ended the brief and unlikely political partnership of two future presidents. They would work together again one day, and for the same cause that preoccupied them in Albany. But their relations would never be as friendly. Although Roosevelt was reported to be beaming with smiles on his return to the Capitol, he was still privately tortured with sorrow. His colleagues in the House had found him a changed man since the double tragedy of 14 February. You could not mention the fact that his wife and mother had been taken away. You could see at once that it was a grief too deep. There were signs that the pain inside him was increasing rather than diminishing, due no doubt to its too cruel suppression. Legislative work was no longer a distraction. He was offered renomination for a fourth term, but refused. He simply could not face the thought of another winter in Albany. With all his soul, he longed now to get away from the dull Dutch town, away from New York with its bitter memories, away to the therapeutic emptiness of the Badlands. Even Chicago, which had so recently seemed such a thrilling prospect, now loomed like a wearisome chore. On 30 April, he unburdened himself to the editor of the Utica Morning Herald in an unusually self-revelatory letter. "I wish to write you a few words just to thank you for your kindness towards me, and to assure you that my head will not be turned by what I well know was a mainly accidental success. Although not a very old man, I have yet lived a great deal in my life, and I have known sorrow too bitter and joy too keen to allow me to become either cast down or elated for more than a very brief period over any success or defeat. I have very little expectation of being able to keep on in politics. My success so far has only been won by absolute indifference to my future career, for I doubt if any man can realize the bitter and venomous hatred with which I am regarded by the very politicians who at Utica supported me, under dictation from masters who are influenced by political considerations that were national and not local in their scope. I realize very thoroughly the absolutely ephemeral nature of the hold I have upon the people, and a very real and positive hostility I have excited among the politicians. I will not stay in public life unless I can do so on my own terms, and my ideal, whether lived up to or not, is rather a high one. For very many reasons, I will not mind going back into private life for a few years. My work this winter has been very harassing, and I feel tired and restless. For the next few months, I shall probably be in Dakota, and I think I shall spend the next 2 or 3 years in making shooting trips, either in the far west or in the northern woods, and there will be plenty of work to do writing. When Henry Cabot Lodge and Theodore Roosevelt arrived in Chicago on Saturday, 31 May, they were already close friends. Earlier that month, the 34-year-old Bostonian had written the 25-year-old Knickerbocker congratulating him on his election as delegate at large from New York and proposing a joint visit to Washington to interview Senator Edmunds before the convention started. On the very day that Roosevelt received this letter, he had been writing a similar one to Lodge, congratulating him, in turn, on his election as delegate-at-large from Massachusetts. He accepted Lodge's invitation with pleasure and asked him to stay over at 6 West 57th Street en route. "We are breaking up house, so you will have to excuse very barren accommodations." Thus, with an exchange of mutual flattery, an evening of echoing conversation in the Roosevelt mansion, and a pilgrimage to the city of their destiny, Lodge and Roosevelt laid the foundation of one of the great friendships in American political history. At first sight, the two men seemed an unlikely pair. Next to the wiry, bouncing, voluble Roosevelt, Lodge was tall, haughty, quiet, and dry. His beard was sharp, his coat tightly buttoned, his handshake quickly withdrawn. His eyes, forever screwed up and blinking, surveyed the world with aristocratic disdain. A heavy mustache clamped his mouth aggressively shut. On the rare occasions when the thin lips parted, they emitted a series of metallic noises which, according to Lodge's whim, might be a quotation from Prosper Mérimée, or a joke comprehensible only to those of the bluest blood and most impeccable tailoring, or a personal insult so stinging as to paralyze all powers of repartee. Only in conditions of extreme privacy would Henry Cabot Lodge unbend an inch or so and allow the privileged few to call him Pinky. Among his own kind, Lodge was said to be a man of considerable wit and charm. But the large mass of humanity, including most of the political establishment, found him repellently cold. By no amount of persuasion could he be made to see any other man's view if it differed from his own. Those who ventured to disagree with him were crushed with sarcasm or, worse still, ignored. Although he had served only 2 terms in the Massachusetts House of Representatives, as opposed to Roosevelt's 3 in Albany, La-di-da Lodge was already on his way to becoming one of America's most disliked politicians. Yet nobody could deny that he was a man of extraordinary caliber. His promises, once made, were never broken. His treatment of both friends and enemies was unshakably fair. As for his attitude to government, it was as high-minded as a philosopher's. This latter characteristic, of course, attracted Roosevelt instantly. But the younger man was also drawn to Lodge's mind, which was more erudite than his own. Lodge had not been deprived by childhood invalidism of a full classical education. After graduating from Harvard, he had become an editor, with Henry Adams, of the North American Review, and had collaborated with that august intellectual in a book on the history of Anglo-Saxon law. More recently, he had published biographies of George Cabot, 1877, Alexander Hamilton, 1882, and Daniel Webster, 1883, as well as A Short History of the American Colonies, 1881. Lodge was now, in 1884, an overseer of Harvard College, chairman of the Massachusetts Republican Party, and a candidate for Congress. No wonder Roosevelt admired this scholar in politics. Lodge, in turn, admired Roosevelt's raw force and superior political instinct. The two had, besides, many things in common: aristocratic manners, wealth, a love of elegant clothes, membership in the Porcellian, early marriages to beautiful women. The Cabot blood shared by both Lodge and Alice Lee was another bond, albeit unspoken. Massive egos, and a ruthless ambition. Theirs was a relationship in which occasional clashes of personality merely emphasized identical taste and breeding, as one or two dissonant notes enriched the larger harmonies of a major chord. No sooner had Roosevelt checked into the Grand Pacific Hotel, New York's headquarters, than newspapermen began to cluster around him. With his chipper straw hat, natty cane, and new French calf low-cut shoes, he was more specifically an object of curiosity than any other stranger in Chicago. Lodge, too, attracted attention with his crisp short hair, full beard, and an appearance of half-shut eyes. But it was politics, not appearances, that made reporters cluster around them. Word had spread that they might prove pivotal figures at the convention, beginning Tuesday. Under the patronage of old George William Curtis, the snow-whiskered civil service reformer and editor of Harper's Weekly, Roosevelt and Lodge were leaders of the independent forces. They had spent most of the month rounding up Edmunds delegates by mail. Although their power was too slight to affect the nomination of one clear favorite, they could possibly play two favorites off against each other and then push the nomination of Senator Edmunds as a compromise. In other words, Roosevelt hoped to repeat his successful Utica performance. The numbers at Chicago were much larger, and the list of candidates longer, at least 9 as of midnight Saturday. But he had at least one trend in his favor. President Arthur and James G. Blaine were running neck and neck with about 300 delegates apiece. Edmunds lay third with 90. All the other dark horses were far behind. Making the most of their news value, Roosevelt and Lodge announced loudly and repeatedly that they would stay with their candidate until the end. Yet both added sotto voce to at least one reporter that if either Arthur or Blaine were nominated, they, as loyal Republicans, would of course support him. It was a considerable admission for their ideological rejection of both candidates, especially the decidedly mottled Blaine, was total. Editors buried the remarks beneath thousands of words of more frivolous pre-convention copy. In 1927, Nicholas Murray Butler, president of Columbia University and an old friend of Theodore Roosevelt, remembered the Republican National Convention of 1884 as the ablest body of men that ever came together in America since the original Constitutional Convention. At the time, it was considered just the opposite, a disgrace to decency and a blot upon the reputation of our country, to quote Andrew D. White. Roosevelt himself was unimpressed by most of his fellow conventioneers. 6 days of politicking with them were enough to convince him that, often as not, vox populi was the voice of the devil, or, what is still worse, the voice of a fool. All the same, he certainly met most of the emerging leaders whose talents Butler so admired, and registered their faces in his photographic memory. Vastly outnumbering these men of the future were the old guard, veteran party members who had voted for Fremont and shed their blood for Lincoln and Grant, men who had prospered mightily under the spoils system for almost a quarter of a century of Republican power. They held the party and its orthodox ideology so holy that some of them cast their delegate badges in gold. Those from the West and from Pennsylvania arrived full of whiskey and love for James G. Blaine. Those from the South and from Wall Street formed glee clubs to sing the praises of President Arthur. Both groups brought bags of boodle to purchase the votes of uncommitted delegates. They looked askance at the Edmunds men, who not only refused to be bought, but sanctimoniously shut up shop on Sunday morning. Independents were promptly accused of having more ice than blood in their blue northeastern veins, and it became standard procedure, whenever anybody like Henry Cabot Lodge walked by, for members of the old guard to turn up their coat collars and shiver ostentatiously. The schoolboy Roosevelt, with his inexhaustible supply of insufferable dudism and conceit, aroused their particular scorn, even though they could not help being impressed by his mental powers. One old delegate remarked, after meeting him, that all the brains intended for others of the Roosevelt family had evidently fallen into the cranium of young Theodore. To see the Chicago Convention as far as possible through Roosevelt's eyes, it is necessary to remember how desperately he had been driving himself through the last 3 months, how full of private grief he was, and how he longed during this final crescendo of political bedlam for the silence and solace of the Badlands. The events of the next week may best be visualized through a red blur of fatigue, which thickened as day followed night, with barely a pause for sleep. Midnight, Monday, 2 June. Every room, stairway, and corridor in the Grand Pacific Hotel is crammed with garrulous, perspiring delegates. It takes one reporter a quarter of an hour to fight his way up from the lobby to Arthur headquarters on the third floor. All the corrupt element in the Republican Party, he notes en route, seems to be concentrated here working in behalf of Blaine. Brass bands thump in the streets outside, the president's glee clubs roar discordantly, and tabletop orators shout themselves hoarse. But the most omnipresent sound is the soft rustle of boodle. Thomas Collier Platt of New York, Blaine's unofficial treasurer, is rumored to be paying the highest price for votes. Arthur men are running out of money in the effort to compete with him, and impatiently await the arrival of a $50,000 parcel from New York City. Meanwhile, they bolster their bribes with promises of federal jobs. Some wily colored delegates, trading on the white man's traditional inability to distinguish one black face from another, sell themselves over and over to both major candidates, stocking up on free cheese and whiskey, and steadily escalating their prices. The going rate for a black Arkansas vote is already $1,000. "Niggers," growls one Arthur lieutenant, "come higher at this convention than any since the war." 10 a.m., Tuesday, 3 June. Warm, radiant spring weather. The lake, velvety violet, the trees along Michigan Avenue dense with new leaves. Atop the arched glass roof of Exposition Hall, 100 flags flutter and snap. 10,000 people mill excitedly about. Spectator tickets are selling at $40 each. Inside the hall, an immense, luminous space so bright with red, white, and blue bunting that at first it sends a tiny stab of pain into the eyes. An acre or more of light cane chairs, banked up row upon row like the seats of a Roman amphitheater. Parterres, galleries, even the high, wide-open windows are already packed with human flesh. Somewhere a band is playing Gilbert and Sullivan. In the distance, at the focal point of the hall, the chairman's podium is a pyramid of flags and flowers. In front of it hangs a portrait of the assassinated Garfield, replacing the traditional martyr's image of Lincoln. George William Curtis enters on Theodore Roosevelt's arm, at the head of the New York delegation. He is gloomily pleased to note Lincoln's absence. "Those weary eyes are not to see the work that is to be done here," he grunts. After 36 hours of intensive lobbying, the Edmonds men know that they have little chance of preventing the nomination of James G. Blaine. For all his shabby past, for all his two previous failures to capture the nomination, and for all his sincere protestations that the presidency is not for him, the plumed knight has an inexplicable hold upon both party and public. The mere sight of his boozy, silver-bearded features in a train window is enough to make women weep with adoration, and men vow to God that they will never vote for any other Republican. These same features are now ubiquitous on badges and banners and transparencies all over Chicago, and all over Exposition Hall, as the delegates stream in. The independents have one slender hope of averting a Blaine landslide. Late yesterday, the news reached them that the Republican National Committee had designated Powell Clayton, a flagrant supporter of Blaine, to be temporary chairman of the convention. Working through the night, Roosevelt and Lodge have built up enough opposition among Arthur men as well as their own delegates to defeat Clayton and elect instead John R. Lynch, an honorable black congressman from Mississippi. Should this opposition hold through today's balloting, the convention will at least be assured of neutral guidance from the chair. At 12:20, the enormous building is at last full. The band plays "My Country, 'Tis of Thee," and the convention is wrapped to order. A chaplain drones the opening prayer. The first item on the agenda is the election of a chairman, and Powell Clayton's name is duly announced. Then, in pin-drop silence, the skinny figure of Henry Cabot Lodge stands up. His grating voice fills the hall.
"I move you, Mr. Chairman, to substitute the name of the Honorable John R. Lynch of Mississippi."
There is a buzz of indignation. Members of the old guard protest Lodge's motion. "For 40 years, roars one delegate, "the party has automatically endorsed the National Committee's choice for convention chairman. To suggest somebody else is an act of rank disloyalty." Finally, Roosevelt has a chance to rise in support of his friend. Leaping onto a chair and squashing down his wayward spectacles, he begins to speak, with such obvious effort that his body shakes.
"Mr. Chairman, it has been said by the distinguished gentleman from Pennsylvania that it is without precedent to reverse the action of the National Committee. There are, as I understand it, but two delegates to this convention who have seats on the National Committee, and I hold it to be derogatory to our honor, to our capacity for self-government, to say that we must accept the nomination of a presiding officer by another body. It is now, Mr. Chairman, less than a quarter of a century since in this city, the great Republican Party organized for victory and nominated Abraham Lincoln of Illinois, who broke the fetters of the slaves and rent them asunder forever. It is a fitting thing for us to choose to preside over this convention, one of that race whose right to sit within these walls is due to the blood and the treasure so lavishly spent by the founders of the Republican Party." This brief speech, interrupted 6 times by applause, is his only attempt at oratory during the convention. It is praised as neat and effective, blunt and manly. But the significance of the fact that Roosevelt, in his maiden speech before a national audience, has sought to elevate a black man will not be fully appreciated for many years. Lynch is elected by 424 votes to Clayton's 384, a narrow but dramatic victory. Roosevelt, bobbing up and down nervously, accepts congratulations from all over the floor. Judge Joseph Foraker of Ohio is seen engaging him in long and friendly discourse. "I found Mr. Roosevelt to be a young man of rather peculiar qualities," Foraker notes later. "He is a little bit young, and on that account has not quite so much discretion as he will have after a while." At midnight, Roosevelt is still strenuously booming for Edmonds. His estimates of the senator's strength are noticeably larger than anybody else's. Wednesday, 4 June. A dreary, drizzly day. Routine business in Exposition Hall does not disguise the fact that more and more delegates are pledging themselves to Blaine. The independents cannot hide their weariness and disillusionment. "Only Roosevelt," says the New York Sun, "is still bubbling with martial ardor as he dashes to and fro on behalf of his candidate." All day long, through the evening session and on into the early hours of Thursday morning, he continues his hopeless battle. He has long since realized that 90 Edmonds men cannot stop the plumed knight. Their only hope now is to join ranks with those supporting some other reform candidate, such as John Sherman or Robert Lincoln. Meanwhile, both he and Lodge are plotting to delay the final ballot as long as possible, in the hope that Blaine's men will eventually begin to fight each other out of sheer frustration. Thursday, 5 June. Solid rain and sullen tempers. The delay strategy seems to be working. There are rumors that balloting will not begin until tomorrow, maybe even Saturday. Sporadic fistfights and cane whackings break out in the Grand Pacific Hotel. By the time Exposition Hall opens its doors, even Roosevelt is too tired to vault to his seat. He plods purposefully down the aisle, surrounded by an anxious crowd of independents. Later, he is glimpsed with his arm around some Ohio delegate's neck, tugging restlessly at his mustache, and looking out of the corner of his eyeglasses at the ladies in the east box. During the long, tension-filled reading of the party platform, and through the hours of irascible debate that follow, Congressman William McKinley of Ohio suddenly emerges as a leading figure in the convention. With unctuous smile and soothing voice, he moves about the floor, quelling arguments before they spread. In the words of Andrew D. White, he is calm, substantial, quick, strong, evidently a born leader of men. As McKinley's star brightens, Roosevelt's begins to fade. Exhaustion is setting in. He rises to question a point of procedure and is crushed by the retort that the point has already been made clear. As he apologizes, "I did not distinctly hear," and sits down, some sparrows fly in from outside and squat mockingly on the gas fixture above his head. The nominating speeches begin at 7:30 p.m. and continue long past midnight. 12,000 pairs of lungs and 40 gas chandeliers suck more oxygen out of the air than the windows can replenish. Yet Roosevelt remains wide awake throughout the evening's interminable oratory. He writes Bammy afterward, "Some of the nominating speeches were very fine, notably that of Governor Long of Massachusetts for Edmonds, which was the most masterly and scholarly effort I have ever listened to. Blaine was nominated by Judge West,
the blind orator of Ohio. It was a most impressive scene. The speaker, a feeble old man of shrunk but gigantic frame, stood looking with his sightless eyes toward the vast throng that filled the huge hall. As he became excited, his voice rang like a trumpet, and the audience became worked up to a condition of absolutely uncontrollable excitement and enthusiasm. For a quarter of an hour at a time, they cheered and shouted so that the brass bands could not be heard at all, and we were nearly deafened by the noise. If the New York Times is to be believed, Roosevelt and Lodge begin another Stop Blaine movement immediately after adjournment, and work right through the night trying to marshal uncommitted delegates behind some candidate, new or old, whom everybody can support. Friday, 6 June. Black Friday with the reformers in the Republican Party, as one correspondent puts it, begins at 11:30 a.m. with the slam of Chairman Lynch's gold-ringed gavel. There can be no more delays. The first ballot is called. Amid cheers, hisses, and boos, the secretary announces the tally. With 411 votes required for nomination, James G. Blaine has 334 and a half. Chester A. Arthur, 278. George F. Edmonds, 93. On the second ballot, Blaine's support increases, while that of Edmonds declines. The third ballot brings Blaine within 36 votes of the nomination. Even now, Roosevelt will not give up. He starts rushing frantically from delegation to delegation, while Judge Foraker moves to adjourn so that a final line of defense against Blaine can be organized. The motion is shouted down, but Roosevelt jumps into his chair, yelling for a roll call until he is red in the face. By now, the entire hall is reverberating with whistles and catcalls. He continues to shout and gesticulate. When a delegate from New Jersey tells him to sit down and stop your noise, his temper cracks. "Shut up your own head, you damned scoundrel, you!" The chair rejects his point of order on a technicality. However, Roosevelt does succeed, says the Chicago Tribune, in rousing the admiring remarks of the fair sex, who enthused over his 28 years and glasses. Once again, William McKinley pours oil on troubled waters. "Let us have no technical objections. I am as good a friend of James G. Blaine as he has in this convention, and I insist that every man here shall have fair play." The motion to adjourn is voted on and defeated. Roosevelt sits, pale, jerky, and nervous, as the fourth ballot proceeds. "I was at the birth of the Republican Party," murmurs old George William Curtis, "and I fear I am to witness its death." The sun streams in through the high windows, flooding the hall with yellow light. A secretary begins to announce the tally. One Arthur delegate retires to the wings, brushes tears from his eyes, and changes his purple badge for a white one. It is all over. In a hurricane of hats, umbrellas, and handkerchiefs, and what is generally calculated to be the loudest roar in the history of American politics, McKinley pushes smilingly through the crowd. He bends over Roosevelt's chair, asks him to second a motion making the nomination unanimous. Roosevelt shakes his head. McKinley turns to Curtis. The old man shakes his head too. Outside, as the delegates disperse in the warm afternoon, Roosevelt snaps at a world reporter, "I am going cattle ranching in Dakota for the remainder of the summer and a part of the fall. What I shall do after that, I cannot tell you." Asked if he will support the party's choice for president, he replies with angrily flashing spectacles, "That question I decline to answer. It is a subject that I do not care to talk about." At midnight, he is still too wrought up to sleep. He tells an Evening Post editor that, rather than vote for Blaine, he would give hearty support to any decent Democrat. More than anything, this rash remark reveals that Roosevelt is politically and physically at the end of his tether. The editor does not print it. Yet. Saturday, 7 June. Henry Cabot Lodge heads east to muse on the future. Theodore Roosevelt heads west to forget about the past. He craves nothing so much as the shade of his front porch, the lowing of his own cattle, the soothing scratch of his pen across paper. Yet even at St. Paul, the roar of Chicago pursues him. A reporter from the Pioneer Press demands to know if he will accept Blaine's nomination or bolt. Some sixth sense warns Roosevelt that bolt is the most fatal word in American politics. "I shall bolt the convention by no means," he says at last. "I have no personal objections to Blaine." With that, Roosevelt changes trains and rumbles off to Little Missouri. A boyhood ambition is rising within him. He will take a rifle, load up a horse, and ride off into the prairie, absolutely alone, for days and days, far off from all mankind. Chapter 11. The Cowboy of the Present. Heart's dearest, why dost thou sorrow so? The stars were already pale in the east as he rode across the river bottom and struck off up a winding valley. His horse, Manitou, loped effortlessly through a sea of sweet-smelling prairie rose bushes. Presently the sun's first rays rushed horizontally across the badlands, kissing the tops of the buttes and shocking millions of drowsy birds into song. Among the swelling chorus of hermit thrushes, grosbeaks, robins, bluebirds, thrashers, and sparrows, Roosevelt's acute ear caught one particularly rich and bubbling sound with a cadence of wild sadness inexpressibly touching. He identified it as the meadowlark. Ever afterward, the music of that bird would come, laden with 100 memories and associations, with the sight of dim hills reddening in the dawn, with the breath of cool morning winds blowing across lowly plains, with the scent of flowers on the sunlit prairie. Some varieties of birdsong, however much they ravished Roosevelt's ear, aroused in his heart that same sharp, indefinable nostalgia which he had felt as a child gazing at the portrait of Edith Carrow. Ache though he may, he could not escape hearing them in Dakota in June, a month of prodigious migrations. Nor did he really want to. For 4 years or more, he had been starved of this, the only kind of music he really understood. In abandoning his natural history studies for Alice Lee, he had stifled the precocious sensitivity to nature that was so characteristic of him as a youth. Now, as a 25-year-old widower, with his second career abandoned, or at least indefinitely postponed, he could reopen his ears to the sweet, sad songs of the hermit thrush, the boding call of the whippoorwill, and the soft, melancholy cooing of the mourning dove, whose voice always seems far away and expresses more than any other sound in nature the sadness of gentle, hopeless, never-ending grief. Two magpies, perched on a bleached buffalo skull, greeted him as he left the creek and rode through a line of scoria red buttes. The naked prairie opened out ahead, already hot and shimmering under the climbing sun. Choosing one course at random, he headed south, scanning the horizon for antelope. All he carried, beside his rifle, was a book, a blanket, an oilskin, a metal cup, a little tea and salt, and some dry biscuits. Since arriving in Dakota 9 days before, he had eaten nothing but canned pork and starch. Ferris and Merrifield were too busy with the spring roundup to shoot any fresh meat. Roosevelt, therefore, had good dietetic reasons, as well as his boyish ambition, for embarking on a trip across the prairie. But his real hunger was for solitude. Nowhere, not even at sea, does a man feel more lonely than when riding over the far-reaching, seemingly never-ending plains. Their vastness and loneliness and their melancholy monotony have a strong fascination for him. The landscape seems always the same, and after the traveler has plodded on for miles and miles, he gets to feel as if the distance were really boundless. As far as the eye can see, there is no break. Either the prairie stretches out into perfectly level flats, or else there are gentle rolling slopes. When one of these is ascended, immediately another precisely like it takes its place in the distance, and so roll succeeds roll in a succession as interminable as that of the waves in the ocean. Nowhere else does one feel so far off from all mankind. The plains stretch out in deathless and measureless expanse, and as he journeys over them, they will for many miles be lacking in all signs of life. Lonely, melancholy, monotony, deathless. These words, especially the first, became obsessive parts of Roosevelt's vocabulary in 1884. There was, however, no shortage of his favorite adjective, manly, and his favorite pronoun, I. While accepting that his first few days on the prairie must have had their moments of anguish, since Alice's death he had not been alone for more than a few hours at a time, one cannot read his descriptions of the trip without sensing his overwhelming delight in being free at last. Black care, Roosevelt wrote, rarely sits behind a rider whose pace is fast enough. He sighted several small bands of antelope that morning. For hours he pursued them, first on foot, then on hands and knees, and finally flat on his face, wriggling through patches of cactus. But the nervous creatures were off before he could draw a bead. After a lunch of biscuits and water and a snooze in the broiling sun, the only shade available was that of his own hat, he pushed on doggedly. Once, horse and rider were very nearly engulfed in a quicksand, and it was only by frantic strugglings and flounderings that we managed to get over. Roosevelt learned to stay well clear of stands of tall grass in seemingly dry creeks. Beneath might lurk a fathomless bed of slime. He learned, too, that fleeing antelope have a quasi-military tendency to gallop in straight lines, even when intercepted at an angle. Taking advantage of this, he succeeded eventually in rolling over one fine buck, like a rabbit. Cutting off the hams and head, and stringing them to his saddle, he rode in search of a campsite. Around sunset, he found a wooded creek with fresh pools and succulent grass. Turning Manitou loose to browse, Roosevelt lit a fire for cheerfulness, cut himself an antelope steak, and roasted it on a forked stick. Later, he lay on his blanket under a wide-branching cottonwood tree, looking up at the stars until I fell asleep in the cool air. The shrill yipping of prairie dogs awoke him shortly before dawn. It was now very chill, and wreaths of light mist hung over the water. Roosevelt reached for his rifle and strolled through the dark trees out onto the prairie. Nothing was in sight in the way of game, but overhead a skylark was singing, soaring above me so high that I could not make out his form in the gray morning light. I listened for some time, and the music never ceased for a moment, coming down clear, sweet, and tender from the air above. Soon the strains of another answered from a little distance off, and the two kept soaring and singing as long as I stayed to listen. And when I walked away, I could still hear their notes behind me. On returning to the camp at sunrise, Roosevelt caught sight of a doe going down to the water, her great sensitive ears thrown forward as she peered anxiously and timidly around. Gun forgotten, he watched enchanted while she drank her fill. She snatched some hasty mouthfuls of wet grass. Presently a spotted fawn joined her. When they left, the pond was taken over by a mallard and her ducklings, balls of fuzzy yellow down that bobbed off into the reeds as I walked by. Roosevelt was back at the Maltese Cross Ranch on 22 June, having spent 5 days in the wilderness, feeling as absolutely free as any man could feel. He might have stayed away longer, but he did not wish his venison to spoil in the hot sun. The little log cabin was deserted. Ferris and Merrifield had left for St. Paul with $26,000 of his money to purchase 1,000 new head of cattle. They would not be back for another month. He felt too restless to settle down and begin the riding he had vaguely planned for summer. Next day he was in the saddle again, riding downriver. En route, he stopped at Medora to pick up some mail and was able to take his first good look around since returning to the Badlands. The hamlet of last fall, with its giant chimney and scattered half-finished houses, was now a bustling town of 84 buildings, including a hotel which the Marquis de Moray had modestly named after himself. Little Missouri, meanwhile, was already slipping into ghosthood on the other side of the river. Trains no longer stopped there. Medora, clearly, was the future capital of the Badlands. A spirit of lusty optimism pervaded the place. Roosevelt, tethering Manitou and gazing about him, could not help but respond to it. The beef business was prospering. It had been a mild winter, and plenty of fat steers were ambling to their doom in the slaughterhouse. A record number of calves had been born to replace them, 155 at Maltese Cross alone. Daily consignments of dressed meat were being shipped east by the Marquis's Northern Pacific Refrigerator Car Company. Meanwhile, de Moray was spawning new business ideas with codfish-like fertility. He would plant 50,000 cabbages in the Little Missouri Valley, and force-feed them with his own patented fertilizer made from offal. He would run a stagecoach line along the eastern rim of the Badlands. He would invest $10,000 in a huge blood-drying machine. He would extend a chain of ice houses as far west as Oregon, so that Columbia River salmon could be whisked cold and fresh to New York in 7 days. He would open a pottery in Medora to process the fine local clay. He would string a telegraph line all the way south to the Black Hills. He would supply the French army with a delicious new soup he had invented. As fast as these schemes flourished or failed, the Marquis would think of others. It is not definitely known whether Roosevelt met the Marquis in Medora that Monday, but they would have had difficulty avoiding each other. De Moray was the most ubiquitous person in town, given to riding up and down the street in a large white sombrero, his blue shirt laced with yellow silk cord, his mustaches prickling haughtily. Tall, wiry, and muscular, he sat his horse more gracefully than any cowboy. Gunmen treated him with sacred respect. His reputation as a sharpshooter was exceeded only by the vivacious and red-headed Madame de Moray. Almost certainly the couple entertained Roosevelt with iced champagne, this being their invariable custom whenever a distinguished stranger came to town. The atmosphere may have been a little stiff at first, for there had been a dispute over grazing rights between the Marquis and Roosevelt's cattlemen during the winter. But it is a matter of record that Roosevelt and de Moray were soon conferring on subjects of mutual interest and planning a visit to Montana together. Before continuing his expedition downriver, Roosevelt dropped in at the office of Medora's weekly newspaper, The Badlands Cowboy. Its editor, a bearded, flap-eared, engaging youth named Arthur Packard, had disquieting news. According to Eastern dispatches, much political vituperation was being lavished on the names Roosevelt and Lodge. The former's railroad interview at St. Paul, stating that he had no personal objections to James G. Blaine, and the latter's announcement on returning to Boston that he, too, would support the Chicago Convention's choice, had enraged the Reform press. Clearly, they had been expected to follow George William Curtis and a host of other prominent independents out of the Republican Party. Roosevelt showed little interest, merely saying that the St. Paul reporter had misquoted him out of asininity. Politics must have seemed impossibly remote and irrelevant in Packard's whitewashed, inky-smelling office, with its slugs of type spelling out news of more immediate interest to do with horse thievery and the price of fresh manure. Remounting Manitou, Roosevelt rode out of Medora and headed north into the green bottomlands of the Little Missouri. The next issue of the Badlands Cowboy briefly reported that a new dude had arrived in town. Theodore Roosevelt, the young New York reformer, made us a very pleasant call Monday in full cowboy regalia. New York will certainly lose him for a time at least, as he is perfectly charmed with our free Western life and is now figuring on a trip into the Bighorn Country. When Packard's news item appeared, Roosevelt was at least 30 miles north, well beyond the farthest reach of ranch settlement. He was looking for untrodden ground on which to build a ranch house. The Maltese Cross log cabin, situated only 8 miles south of Medora, did not satisfy his present hunger for solitude. A popular pony trail passed within a few yards of the front door. 10 or 12 cowpunchers galloping by every week amounted, as far as he was concerned, to an intolerable amount of traffic noise. Worse still, at least half of them wanted to stop off and pass the time of day. How could a man write with so many interruptions? He wanted to live where the peace of nature was total. Acting on a tip from a friendly cattleman, Roosevelt kept splashing across the meandering river, heading directly north until he reached a magnificent stretch of bottomland on the left bank. Grass spread smoothly back from the water's edge for 100 yards, merging into a belt of immense cottonwood trees. This bird-loud grove extended a farther 200 yards west. Then a range of clay hills, which seemed to have been sculpted by a giant hand as preparatory studies for mountains, loomed steeply into the sky. A distant plume of lignite smoke, glowing pink as evening came on, hinted at the surrounding savagery of the Badlands. No place could be more remote from the world, yet more insulated from the wilderness. Roosevelt knew he had found his hold in Dakota. Here he would build a long, low ranch house of hewn logs with a veranda, and with an addition to the other rooms, a bedroom for myself and a sitting room with a big fireplace. There would be a rough desk, well stocked with ink and paper, 2 or 3 shelves full of books, and a rubber tub to bathe in. Out front, on a piazza overlooking the river, there would be the inevitable Rooseveltian rocking chair, in which he could sit reading poetry on summer afternoons, or watching his cattle plod across the sandbars. At night, when he came back tired and bloody from hunting, there would be a welcoming flicker of firelight through the cottonwood trees, plenty of fresh meat to eat, and beds spread with buffalo robes. Of course, several practical things had to be done before these dreams were realized. He must first claim the site. The presence of a hunting shack nearby meant he would probably have to buy squatters' rights. He must order many more cattle. He must hire men to build the house and run the ranch for him. As it happened, he already had 2 recruits for the latter job. His 2 old friends from the backwoods of Maine, Bill Sewell and Wilmot Dow. On 9 March 1884, less than 3 weeks after burying Alice, Roosevelt had written to Sewell with a rather peremptory invitation to join him in Dakota. "I feel sure you will do well for yourself by coming out with me. I shall take you and Will Dow out next August." What persuaded him that a pair of forest-bred Easterners would flourish in the Badlands is unclear, but Sewell and Dow were agreeable. Their motives appear to have been pecuniary. "He said he would guarantee us a share of anything made in the cattle business," Sewell recalled. "And if anything was lost, he would lose it and pay our wages. I told him that I thought it was very one-sided, but if he thought he could stand it, I thought we could." There were minor hindrances, such as mortgages and protesting wives, but Roosevelt settled the former with a check for $3,000 and assured Mrs. Sewell and Mrs. Dow that they could come west in a year if all went well. Within a few days of discovering the Downriver ranch site in June, he purchased full rights to both shack and land for $400. Before returning east to pick up Sewell and Dow, he found time to make his scheduled visit to Montana with the Marquis de Moray. The date of this trip was deliberately kept secret, but 26 June seems likely. The Marquis would have found it prudent to be out of town that day, since it was the first anniversary of Riley Luffsey's murder. The two young men wished to sign on as members of a band of vigilantes, or stranglers, which had just been organized in Miles City, its purpose being to lynch the horse thieves currently plaguing the Dakota-Montana border. Fortunately for Roosevelt's subsequent political reputation, their application was refused. Granville Stewart, leader of the vigilantes, told them that they were too socially prominent to belong to a secret society. On 1 July, Roosevelt left Medora for New York. He found Baby Lee, all blue eyes and blonde curls, living with Bammy at 422 Madison Avenue. Henceforth, this house would be his pied-à-terre on visits to New York, although Bammy was not keen on the idea of brother and sister sharing the same town address. Much as she loved to look after him, she was afraid they might drift into a cozy, quasi-marital relationship centering around her quasi-daughter. Bammy was a person of fine instinct and disciplined emotions, unlike Corrine, who could never see enough of her Teddy, and for whom he could never do wrong. But Bammy need not have worried. Roosevelt showed no desire to remain at number 422 a moment longer than necessary. Sewell and Dow were ordered to fix up their affairs at once and hurry to New York so that they could leave for Dakota by the end of the month. Then Roosevelt took the ferry to New Jersey for a few days with Corrine. He seemed anxious to stay away from his daughter, who was now almost 5 months old. Since going to Dakota, he had not asked a single question about the child in his letters home. No record remains of their reunion. It is known, however, that after leaving New Jersey, he took little Alice to Boston to see her grandparents. The visit cannot have been cheerful. At the soonest possible moment, he fled Chestnut Hill for Nahant, Henry Cabot Lodge's summer place. A sentence in one of Aunt Annie Gracie's letters provides a clue, perhaps, to Roosevelt's curious terror of Baby Lee. "She is a very sweet, pretty little girl, so much like her beautiful young mother in appearance." Nor was this his only phobia that summer. In New York, Bammy was told to warn him if a certain old family friend came to call, so that he could arrange to be absent. As a married man, he had been able to withstand the cool blue eyes of Edith Carrow. But now, widowed and alone, it was as if he feared they might once again find him childishly vulnerable. On 11 July, the Democratic National Convention nominated Grover Cleveland for President of the United States. The governor was in Albany, working as usual, when at 1:45 p.m., the dull booming of cannons floated through the windows of his office. An aide tried to congratulate him. "They are firing a salute, Governor, for your nomination."
"Do you think so? Well, anyhow, we'll finish up this work."
Roosevelt found Lodge depressed during his short stay at Nahant. The extent to which independent revulsion had gathered against James G. Blaine, and, by extension, against Lodge for supporting him, must have amazed them both. Almost to a man, the intellectual and social aristocracy of Massachusetts had decided to vote for Cleveland. The list of Republican opponents to Blaine contained such names as Adams, Quincy, Lowell, Saltonstall, Everett, and Elliott. These were the same names which had so often been borne on a silver tray into Lodge's parlor. Now, suddenly, the tray was empty, and his friends were snubbing him in the street. Lodge confessed that supporting Blaine was "the bitterest thing I ever had to do in my life." What particularly hurt was the widespread assumption that he had sold his conscience for a congressional nomination in the fall. It was time, Roosevelt decided, to come to the aid of his stricken friend. He himself had said nothing publicly since his confession of support for Blaine at St. Paul, except to telegraph an ambiguous denial of the interview from Medora. No sooner had he returned to Chestnut Hill on 19 July than he summoned a reporter from the Boston Herald and announced, once and for all, that he, too, would support the Republican presidential ticket. "While at Chicago, I told Mr. Lodge that such was my intention, but before announcing it, I wished to have time to think the whole matter over. A man cannot act both without and within the party. He can do either, but he cannot possibly do both. I am by inheritance and education a Republican. Whatever good I have been able to accomplish in public life has been accomplished through the Republican Party. I have acted with it in the past and wish to act with it in the future. I went as a regular delegate to the Chicago Convention, and I intend to abide by the outcome of that convention. I am going back in a day or two to my western ranches, as I do not expect to take any part in the campaign this fall." He arrived back in New York to find Bammy's doormat piled with abusive letters. "Most of my friends seemed surprised to find that I had not developed hoofs and horns," he wryly told Lodge. Harder to take, perhaps, was the criticism of Alice's family, voiced by her uncle, Henry Lee. "As for Cabot Lodge, nobody's surprised at him. But you can tell that young whippersnapper in New York from me that his independence was the only thing in him we cared for, and if he has gone back on that, we don't care to hear any more about him." Reform newspapers, whose hero Roosevelt had so recently been, were loud in their denunciations of him. The Evening Post thundered that no ranch or other hiding place in the world could shelter a so-called independent who voted for the likes of James G. Blaine. Roosevelt sent a mischievous message to the editor, Edwin L. Godkin, accusing him of suffering from a species of moral myopia complicated with intellectual strabismus. Godkin, who was a man of little humor, forthwith became his severest public critic. Roosevelt did not seem to mind his sudden unpopularity. When the rumor that Grover Cleveland was the father of a bastard flashed across the country on 21 July, he could afford to laugh at the independents who had already bolted to the governor's side. Although he seemed in a final interview on 26 July to be talking only about his life out west, he subtly sounded a favorite theme, that of the masculine hardness of the practical politician as opposed to the effeminate softness of armchair idealists. "It would electrify some of my friends who have accused me of representing the kid-glove element in politics if they could see me galloping over the plains day in and day out, clad in a buckskin shirt and leather chaparajos, with a big sombrero on my head. For good, healthy exercise, I would strongly recommend some of our gilded youth to go west and try a short course of riding bucking ponies and assist at the branding of a lot of Texas steers." With that, the ex-assemblyman boarded a train with Sewell and Dow and returned to Dakota. "Well, Bill, what do you think of the country?" asked Roosevelt. It was 1 August 1884, and the two backwoodsmen were spending their first night in the Badlands at the Maltese Cross Ranch.
"I like it well enough," said Sewell, "but I don't believe that it's much of a cattle country."
"You don't know anything about it," Roosevelt protested. Sewell obstinately went on.
"It's the way it looks to me, like not much of a cattle country."
Roosevelt shrugged off this remark. With 1,000 new head just arrived from Minnesota, the best lot of cattle shipped west this year, said the Badlands cowboy, and 600 veterans of last winter browsing contentedly on the river, he could see no reasons for pessimism. The next morning, he ordered Sewell and Dow north to the Downriver ranch site with 100 head to practice on. They left under the supervision of a grumpy herder, who was doubtful about Sewell's capacity to stay on his horse. Sewell, jouncing along uncomfortably, allowed that he had more experience riding logs. Roosevelt remained behind. There was a certain amount of soothing to be done at Maltese Cross. Merrifield and Ferris had not been pleased to discover, on returning from St. Paul, that a couple of eastern lumbermen had displaced them in the boss's esteem. Since Roosevelt intended to build his home ranch downriver and would spend most of his time there, it was obvious whose company he preferred. Merrifield, in particular, was a man of easily bruised ego. Perhaps to mollify him, Roosevelt asked if he would be his guide in a major hunting expedition later that month. This was the trip into the Bighorn country of Wyoming that he had been excitedly planning since June. You will probably not hear from me for a couple of months, he warned Bammy, adding with relish, If our horses give out or run away, or we get caught in the snow, we may be out very much longer, till towards Christmas. He stopped short of telling his nervous